Welcome inside the Yellow Studio. This is how I podcast now. My name is Randy Cantrell. Greetings and welcome inside the Yellow Studio. Welcome to DFW. Today is Thursday, September the 12th, 2019. A special episode of Leaning Toward Wisdom. You'll find the website at leaningtowardwisdom.com. You're going to want to go see it. There are a couple of photographs, and there's at least one particular link that you may be interested in checking out. It only took one day to dismantle the Yellow Studio. It took a small, generous community of podcast supporters to help make it become a reality. The donors are now on a special email list where I have been keeping them updated. This group will continue to remain special. They will continue to enjoy some inside updates. It's just one small way that I can continue to say thank you for making the Rodecaster Pro possible. So in this episode, if you're not interested in a little bit of geeking out on some podcasting technology, then feel free to bail out. But that's the devotion today. Not going to spend a long time with it, but I do want to update everybody. Going to geek out just a little bit for those interested in the technicalities of podcasting. For the rest of you, well, I'll see you the next time. Years ago, when I built the Yellow Studio, there were basically two methods of workflow that were used in podcasting. This is still mostly true. The first was by far the most popular, and it still is very much the most popular because it is the least expensive route. And we're going to call this workflow the recording workflow. Now, to be fair, all podcasts are recorded. That became the very definition of the medium: serialized, subscribable audio content. Well, if it's going to be serialized, it's going to be subscribable, and it's going to be where I can access it anytime I want, then, yeah, okay, duh. It's got to be recorded because we could listen to it at will. That made it very different than radio. We can listen on our own timetable. It's all pretty slick. And we were excited. This is back in the day when we were excited to get an email. You remember that? You may not. Depends on how old you are. We were excited when new email hit our inbox, and we were equally excited when a new episode of our favorite podcast would come down the pike. Recording methodology simply required a microphone and some kind of software to record the audio, and much of that was free. Now, to gussy up the sound, you needed fancier software, so you probably would have to spend a little bit of money. And you also had to spend time editing. You had to go back through after you recorded it. You had to go back through and do whatever magic you wanted to do to make the sound sound some better. The first recording would not necessarily be the final version, and this workflow demanded a significant amount of work after the fact. Broadcasting, that was the other methodology, and this wasn't nearly as popular, and for good reason. It required hardware, which meant it was much more expensive. The hardware was and still is expensive. The benefits, in my opinion, were extraordinarily high. Because the minute you hit record, the sound is recorded digitally exactly as it will sound when listeners hit play. And other than editing for content, you know, if you wanted to get the ums and the ahs out of your recording, but you weren't editing for sound quality, it was much more of a what you hear is what you get kind of a process. I instantly wanted to go the broadcast route, because I preferred to put my work in ahead of hitting the record button. It wasn't about avoiding work. You're not going to avoid the work. At least, I don't think so. And it wasn't about that for me. It was about, when do you want to do the work? You can do the work on the front end before you ever hit record and before you ever sit down in front of a microphone, which basically means you can write. And because I like to write, I wanted to do that. Or you can record and then go back and edit it and maybe edit it some more, which means you got to listen to it. Mostly in real time, you can listen to it at 1.5 speed, maybe even 2, but you still got to go back through. Oh, man, that just, the mere thought of that completely beat me down. I just could not imagine having to go back and do that. Now, I had done some editing back when we had tape, so that may have had something to do with it. When you listen to recordings that were done back in the 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s, you are listening to people who edited a lot of stuff manually, literally cutting and splicing tape. Not a fun process, let me tell you. Digitally is so much better, but even the thought of doing it digitally just absolutely defeated me. Now, if you go the broadcasting route, there's a huge disadvantage, and that is cost and expense, because it means you're going to have to invest in gear. You've got to have hardware. It's the only way to do it. Thankfully, I had the ability to make the investment, and I had some expert help in figuring out what I ought to get. Back in 2015, I recorded an episode, and I gave an inside tour to the Yellow Studio. And I went through every single piece of hardware and gear. I'm not going to do that here because I've already done that. I did that back in 2015 because it was the answer to the question that I would constantly get from people. Well, what does your studio look like? I was referring to the studio as the Yellow Studio. And admittedly, at least early on, my sound was different. I wasn't the only one that had great sound. I'm not saying that, but I had, my sound was different, and especially my sound, I tell you where people most noticed it, anybody that got me on a Skype call. People who would get me on a Skype call would notice, man, what have you got? It sounds awesome. And I would explain to them, well, you know, it should. I've got a rack of gear over here. Well, I embarked on finding and assembling equipment that was mostly broadcast quality, built to withstand hours and hours of nonstop operating without any problems, you know, just the kind of gear that radio stations used. In short, that's what I was building. I was building a small two-mic station with just about everything other than the transmitter, because for me, well, the transmitter was going to be the internet. The microphones, they came first, two Heilsound PR40 microphones. Now, other people, I would learn later, had picked these microphones because of longtime broadcaster, podcaster, Leo Laporte. Leo is a tech guy who has enjoyed radio and internet success, and he used the Heil PR40, and a lot of people wanted to emulate Leo, and he has good pipes, and he had a good sound. Well, I didn't know of Leo. I had no idea who Leo Laporte was when I got the PR40s, but I had heard of Bob Heil. I knew of Bob Heil. I knew of Heil microphones because I was very much into music. And I also had buddies who were steeped into ham radio. And I also had, and I still have, a fondness for the sound of great condenser microphones. Now, I knew my space, the Yellow Studio. I knew this was not going to be an ideal space for a condenser microphone because, well, condenser microphones pick up everything. My space was going to be pretty solid for recording. It was going to be sonically, it was going to be pleasing because I'm surrounded by books and it's a relatively what we call dead space. It doesn't echo. But it wasn't going to be like a professional voice booth that voiceover artists commonly use. It wasn't going to be like a professional recording studio with extensive sound isolation. But I just like the sound of condenser microphones. They've just got a texture to them that was really appealing to me. Enter the PR40. The PR40 is a large diaphragm that has condenser mic qualities in a dynamic mic. So two Heil PR40s, each on its own boom arm, each mounted inside its own shock mount. These shock mounts require, these are the shock mounts, if you've watched me on social media, if you've seen me gripe and moan, these shock mounts have, there's a band in the front and a band in the back. They're kind of like those elastic bands that you tie up a girl's hair with, you know, to put a hair in a ponytail. They're these elastic bands. These beggars are $5 a piece. There's no reason for this. Well, they don't hold their elasticity forever. And mine began to fail sometime back, and so I've ordered some new ones, but $5 a piece. So anyway, each microphone is inside one of those shock mounts. That means I could pound on the table or do any number of things, and it wouldn't really affect the microphone. Not that I do that. Next came the coveted Aphex 230 microphone preamps. Now, radio people and voiceover artists alike have often run to the Aphex sound for years and years. Well, microphones have to be plugged into something that can generate enough gain so you get sound. Enter the preamps. The Aphex 230s, there's one for each microphone, those came next. And they were among the very first items that were installed in this six-unit rack. These units included things like noise gates and compressors and limiters and de-essers and just all sorts of sonic goodies to make your voice just sound outstanding. The Aphex units were great for making me sound terrific. They really were at the heart of it all. And it's what would really get people's attention if they saw me on a Skype call, for instance. At some point, I don't remember what prompted it, but at some point, and I'm going a little bit out of order because I frankly had this piece of gear first because it was, I don't know if it was a gift or what the circumstance of me getting this was, but everything that comes through your computer that you want to take out to a podcast, I'm thinking, well, okay, these Skype calls that I'm doing and these Zoom calls and whatever else I was doing at the time, there's nothing that's processing that sound. Well, enter a TC Electronic Finalizer Express. This was a piece of gear that would put just a nice wash of compression over everything going into the system. If you haven't figured out by now, I'm a fan of compression. Not too much, but some. And this thing had more knobs and dials and lights than you could shake a stick at, but it was a terrific piece of gear. It was, you know, it had so many different settings, it took some time to get it dialed in, but this would give even incoming Skype calls kind of a washover, if you please, and make them sound just crazy good. Phone calls. Okay, well, what about taking phone calls? Well, I wanted to do what radio stations do. I wanted to be able to patch in a call to a recording, and mainly when I was talking with clients, I wanted to be able to record the call, and so if I could patch that through the whole system, then hey, man, what better way to do it than I could supply the conversation in the recording. I could supply that recording back to the client. So I want to be able to patch phone calls directly into the recordings. Enter a staple piece of gear that is found in every radio station in the land. Well, it was at the time, a Telos One. Now, the Telos One has got some technology in it that's just insanely good. It's a really basic device with just very few buttons on it. In fact, one button answers a call, one button hangs up the call, and that's the only button I ever messed with because all the electronics inside the box do the magic. And it was connected to my landline, which eventually became a VoIP line that it was connected to. All of that went through a small broadcast quality mixer that was made by a company called Broadcast Tools. And the mixer was a ProMix 12, built like a tank. The ProMix, it had these long throw faders. That just means they're large and the sound range is more subtle than these short throw faders. But the ProMix 12 is a two mic mixer, 12 channels total, two of them for microphones, so it had preamps, which I didn't need because I had the Aphex 230s. But it had some other cool broadcasting features. Mainly in channel 4, it had a built-in mix minus. All I had to do was patch my Telos phone bridge into channel 4, and then I didn't have to fret about people on the phone hearing themselves echo. That's that mix minus technology. No special engineering skills required. The board just handled it all on its own. It was great. Now, my system was what's called a fully balanced audio system. That meant it was professional grade. It only used XLR and insert cables made with coax and professional connectors. I didn't have a single consumer grade connection anywhere in the system, meaning RCA jacks or these little, you know, mini plugs. But what about connecting to a laptop? What about a phone? What about an iPad? I didn't have any way to do that. So I bought a Yamaha MG124C mixer. It was another 12-channel mixer, and it had RCA inputs, something that the ProMix lacked. So now I could take the main output from the Yamaha mixer into one of the channels on the ProMix, and anytime I would pot up that channel, anything connected to the Yamaha board, I could now bring that into my system. So now I had the best of all worlds. I had professional grade. I had consumer grade. I could connect anything to the system for recording. Now, to route all of that into my computer required an interface of some sort. I mean, you got to get all this into your computer to your software. I had two different versions of a FireWire interface, both made by Presonus. FireWire was way more commonplace when I began umpteen years ago. It has since declined in popularity. I went that route because at the time the speed was much faster than the current USB, which was probably 1.0. For headphone management, I got an Aphex 454 head pod. Sounded great. This is a little $200 headphone amplifier. It provided plenty of volume to all four separate headphone jacks, and each had its own dedicated volume control. I mean, what more do you need? Set right here at my right-hand side for years and years and years. Cable management was a challenge right out of the gate. I mean, figuring out just how to cable all this stuff and what goes where was just a chore, major chore. I never did figure out the sheer footage of cables used to connect all this stuff, but I can tell you right now, it was ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. The number of connections, also ridiculous, because the signal chain was anything but straight. It was anything but short. It was anything but simple. I mean, I had cables going into one thing, coming out of that thing, and going into some other thing, and coming out of that, and going to here, and yeah, it was a nightmare. I just figured this is how it's always going to be. So I got it done, and, you know, heaven help you if you had a problem. You know, if there was a noise or, you know, tracking it down would just be, and it was always going to be a cable. It was always going to be a connector, and it was just, yeah, made me feel like lurch. So I just didn't know any other way, and I knew I was committed to this workflow. The broadcast workflow. Heat. Let's not overlook the heat produced by a rack of gear like I've just described. Temperatures here inside the L studio were likely 2 to 5 degrees, probably hotter than any other room. It's fine during the winter. It ain't so fine during a Texas summer. Power. Okay, well, we're not talking about big power suckage. The Aphex 230s have a tube. A tube preamp, so they're going to draw a little bit more. But, you know, but every time there was a thunderstorm, every time, hello, I'm here in Tornado Alley. Every time there was any threat of power going out, I was scrambling to unplug the rack. Now, I had all the power going through a good quality power management to protect the whole thing. Didn't matter. I wasn't going to risk it. I didn't want to risk a brownout or a blackout from wrecking any of my equipment. So I was constantly, you know, unplugging stuff, shutting stuff down anytime there was a threat of that. And then things changed. It was the summer of 2015. Ironically enough, that was the summer that I did the in-depth tour of the Yellow Studio with all the aforementioned gear. But in that same summer, Rode, an Australian company, acquired Aphex, one of my favorite suppliers. Now, I didn't know quite what Rode might do with Aphex. In fact, it puzzled me at the time because I loved Rode mics. I have a Rode NTG3 shotgun mic in my mic locker. I don't have a mic locker, but people talk about a mic locker. You ever wished you had a mic locker? I don't, but I've got an NTG3. And I loved Aphex, clearly. I mean, I had two Aphex 230s. I had the Aphex headphone amp. Aphex, I was a fan. By the time 2019 rolls around, Rode blew the lid off the podcasting world with a device that was going to incorporate Aphex sound characteristics. Because, see, 4 years ago, they had bought Aphex. They dubbed this thing the Rodecaster Pro. And what the Rodecaster Pro proposed to do, it proposed to be a full podcasting studio based on having four microphone channels. But wait, there's more. It was also going to have a channel built in so that you could hardwire a smartphone, maybe even a tablet. Oh, and if that's not cool enough, it's also going to have another channel where you can Bluetooth that device. Additionally, it's going to have eight big keys that are going to be color-coded along the right side, and these are going to be for sound effects. Now, I was doing that already through software on a laptop, a phone, or an iPad, and patching that in through the Yamaha mixer into the big mixer. Oh, and this new device by Rode, it was also going to have a four-channel headphone amplifier built in, with each channel having its own dedicated volume control. Well, now suddenly, here was going to be a device, a single device, that was going to do everything my studio would do. Now, granted, I had already been operating for years and years, but one piece of gear is going to replace everything that I've mentioned. No, I was going to lose a lot of knobs. I was going to lose a lot of lights. I was going to lose a lot of flexibility in just the individual little tweaky adjustments. But I was also going to lose all those cables. I was also going to lose all that complexity. I was also going to lose this rack of gear. I was also going to lose all this electrical current. I was also going to lose all this heat. One cable going from one mic into the Rode, and that's it. One cable from the iPhone to the Rode. One pair of headphones plugged into each channel. Simple. Straightforward. But what about the sound? What about the sound? I'd been preoccupied about sound. I wanted the sound inside the Yellow Studio to be spectacular. And thanks to my setup, it mostly was. I watched every YouTube review of this Rodecaster Pro, and boy, were there a ton of them. And I listened very carefully. I knew the ease of operation of the product would mean that I would lose these little fine nuances of sound adjustment, you know, but this is podcasting. This is podcasting. We're not recording multi-track music. And this is spoken word. This isn't singing. I mean, how nuanced does the sound really need to be? And so I concluded that any loss of adjustments that I might forfeit in the Rode, it would be more than made up for in just having everything I needed in a single piece of gear. Really simple, really straightforward. Not looking back. You don't see or hear many people talk about it, but the Rodecaster Pro accomplished what I was able to do with my rack of hardware. Live streaming. Live streaming audio quality is identical to the recordings by way of the way I did it with my rack of gear and by way of the Rodecaster Pro. Now, I'm not a big live streaming person, but like I said, I would get people's attention in Skype calls. Man alive, what have you got? Nearly every Skype call, that's how it went. I'm just now seeing live streaming people begin to pick up on the improvements that are possible by way of the Rodecaster Pro. Because when it first came out, I don't think people were necessarily thinking, man, this would be great for live streaming, because now I'm doing everything in real time, aka that broadcast workflow. I'm not recording it and then going back and massaging it before I release it to the world. No, it's you're performing live without a net. Get me on a Skype call, get me on a Zoom web conference, and I'm going to sound just as good as my recordings. That was all thanks to the hardware, but that's also thanks to the Rodecaster Pro. A single USB connection to my Apple iMac, and I am done. Four mics, four cables from each mic to the Rodecaster, four headphones, each plugged in to the Rodecaster, one cable to either an iPhone or an iPad. That's it. That's it. And I gave up nothing in connectivity. I gave up nothing in flexibility. Phone calls? Okay, I can take them. I can record by myself. I can record with a few friends. I can input sounds via the sound cart buttons. That music that you heard at the beginning, that's on a button. I can navigate back and forth with the computer and anything coming into the out of the computer. I got volume knobs for each headphone as well as a master volume control. If the unit isn't perfect, if it's not perfect, it is awful close. Just like you, the listeners of my podcast. You're not the perfect podcast audience, but you are awfully close. You've been listening to the Rodecaster Pro. You heard it in the last episode. And Lord willing, for a long, long time to come, this is what you will hear. It's pretty stinking terrific. It really is. Photographs can be found over at the website leaningtowardwisdom.com. It's great. It really is great. And I didn't even mention about the firmware stuff. Because the device is built the way it's built, Rode has already had two major firmware updates that have completely changed some of the feature sets of this thing. It has a color touchscreen, by the way, that I didn't mention. It has a big record button. Now, I don't record into the Rode. I record into software. I'm still using Twisted Wave. But the firmware updates have allowed multi-track recording. One of the things that it didn't do before the last firmware update that was kind of annoying to me before I bought mine is you didn't know how much time was remaining on like a sound card. Like this music that you hear playing in the background, I wouldn't have been able to have looked at my device to see. And that was something I was accustomed to doing in the software that I was using before. But thanks to the Rode, now I can look and I can see that there's a minute and 40 seconds left in this song. Right? Good to know when you're recording. Live in the fly. And you don't want to go back and do a ton of editing. So I owe you who contributed a big, big thank you for making this possible. You know who you are. I must admit that there are a few people who donated anonymously. It's so annoying. I appreciate it, but really? I mean, yeah, I got a few donations, and the gift cards came through Sweetwater, Anana, Mouse was one. Some others were just anonymous. They didn't want to put their name. So annoying. I can't thank you because I don't know who you are. And you know what's worse? I'm not going to get a story out of you. I'm not going to get what I really, really was clamoring for in Project Craving Encouragement. I'm not going to get a story of encouragement, and I really, really want those. You can find out more by going to leaningtowardwisdom.com/craving. Greetings and welcome inside the Yellow Studio.